Atlanta on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. I am joined now by Jack Layton, leader of the Federal New Democratic Party, a post he was elected to in January 2003. In 2004, he published the best-selling Speaking Out Loud, which set out his vision for Canada. The book has just been updated for paperback, Speaking Out Louder, Ideas That Work for Canadians, retails for $24.95 and is published by Key Porter. Mr. Layton is the Member of Parliament for Toronto Danforth. Please welcome once again to the Plant on the Line program, the Honourable Jack Layton. Good morning, Mr. Layton.
Well, good morning.
Thanks for joining us. When the book first came out, it was suggested by your old student, Don Martin, as a long election brochure. Another critic suggested that it was a utopian blueprint for a fairy tale kingdom. Now that the book's been revised, do we have much of the same?
Well, first of all, when we talk about a utopian vision, I guess whoever was commenting there isn't familiar with the very good ideas around environment, social policy, economic policy, and urbanism, and all of those ideas that we talked about in the book, because every idea we spoke about in the book is already in place, either in somewhere in Canada or elsewhere globally. And what I've found in my life in this sort of work is that there's often solutions out there. The problem is that they haven't been understood, embraced, and promoted and spread around as what we would call best practices. So this book was designed to try and lay some of those out. And of course, between the 2004 edition and the 2006, there were more good ideas that had come to my attention and that were in the process of being implemented by individuals, companies, municipal governments, in some cases provinces, and so we update all that material so that the best ideas currently available are there for people to think about.
How do you think you've done in implementing or influencing government with some of the ideas that you write about in the book?
Well, it was a heck of a lot easier when I was a city councillor and involved with the National Federation of Canadian Municipalities, because, of course, local democracies tend to be very agile, and they're able to respond to and with good ideas much more quickly than a lumbering great federal government beast. And that one's been tougher, I have to say. On the other hand, when you are able to make it move, it moves with considerably more dollars. So when we were able to force Paul Martin and the Liberals to cancel their big corporate tax cut in the budget of 2005, because they were facing electoral defeat at that time and they wanted to carry on, and we said, look, if you'll replace a $4.5 billion tax cut to the biggest profitable companies with investments in public transit, affordable housing, post-secondary education, a low-income housing retrofit program, and protection for people whose pensions are threatened with when there's bankruptcies with companies. If you'll do those things in a balanced budget context, then we'll keep this parliament going, because it would be producing something good for people. And so that's what we did, and some of those machinations and the implications are described in the new edition. So I would have to say that we were able to accomplish some things, nowhere near as much as we'd like to, but then again, that would require more seats.
Your party recently threatened a confidence vote over the Clean Air Act. You broke the logjam in Parliament after meeting with the Prime Minister. What did you both agree to then?
Well, what we agreed to, first of all, was that we quite dramatically disagreed on this whole issue of climate change and what a crisis it is. Our party believes that it is the largest crisis facing humanity today, and that we need to mobilize around solutions very, very fast. He certainly doesn't exhibit that sense of urgency, but I also, I think we agreed that his Clean Air Act wasn't going to go anywhere in this Parliament, because the three opposition parties, rightly, were going to vote against it because it was going to increase pollution. So I said, look, why not create a special committee, send your bill to that committee without any vote, so that there's no commitment to any part of it, and every party can bring forward their best ideas and we'll vote on those best ideas and hopefully come out with a piece of legislation that can move us forward. And I'm glad that he agreed to do that. It remains to be seen whether the various parties are able to actually work together. I mean, that would be somewhat of a shocker, but I guess in some ways it's what I learned in the world of municipal government is that sometimes you can actually pull together around some good ideas and make them happen despite all the old partisan labels and party colors.
How is Stephen Harper to deal with compared to Paul Martin?
Well, I actually go into that in some detail in my book more by just recounting the stories of the meetings I had with them. I think both feel this certain sense of entitlement about governing as though they had the support of the majority of Canadians. Interestingly, neither of them ever did. And I think a little more humility and understanding that maybe working with other parties in a democratic system where you didn't get a majority of votes would be the right thing to do. That would be something beneficial for both of them. But I mean, they have different personal styles. But in the end, you're sitting down talking to an individual who's been chosen by some Canadians from their riding and chosen by their party to lead. And so you simply sit down and talk about the issues as you see them. With Mr. Harper, I gave him a copy of a book called The Weathermakers, which your listeners will probably know, written by Tim Flannery, the professor from Australia, that lays out some of these climate change issues. And I said to Mr. Harper, I really think that on behalf of all of our kids, this is the kind of book that we should all read, and then we should take the impacts that are facing the average working person, not only here in Canada, but globally, and we should take them to heart and try to do something to change the direction that we're currently headed in, which is obviously unsustainable. And I would have to say that in the case of Mr. Martin, it took a parliamentary crisis for him to react to that. In the case of Mr. Harper, I'm not sure that it was the crisis aspect of it. I don't think he really believed that a non-confidence motion would pass this fall, but he did agree that at least we should explore the possibilities, and so that's what we'll do.
So you're finding it easy, though, in this parliament to talk to the government, and you're able to advocate the issues that you feel strongly about, do you think?
Well, I don't mean to say that. In fact, the only discussions we had were back when we were writing the speech from the throne, or the government was, and they sought out the opinion of all the opposition party leaders, but then there was a drought right up until I had to stand up in the House of Commons and say, look, Mr. Prime Minister, your Clean Air Act is dead in the water, which means Canada's going nowhere on climate change. Are you willing to meet with me in the next 24 hours? And the unstated aspect of that, of course, was that we had to table our motion in the House. We as a party, have one motion per session that we can table, and we tabled the one, we could have tabled one for non-confidence, and said, look, if you'll meet in 24 hours, then maybe we can move this thing forward. So I wouldn't say it was a particularly willing or engaging Prime Minister that I was dealing with. It was one who responded to a certain degree, a bit of an ultimatum.
You talked earlier about Mr. Martin and Mr. Harper not getting a majority of support from Canadians. You talk in the book about reforming our electoral system. First past the post, you say, has passed its time. What do you advocate we change the current way we elect MPs with?
Well, we believe we should have a system that's generally known as proportional representation. In other words, that when your House of Commons meets after an election, if 30% of the people voted for a certain party and platform, there should be 30% of the seats in the House that reflect that. And we've recommended that for Canada, so that you can still have that regional representation, you can have your local MP to talk about your local issues, that we should have something called the mixed member system, and that's been recommended also by the Law Reform Commission of Canada, and so that's what we propose. That's our party policy, but we think it would work best for Canada, but we'll have to see what other parties advocate on it, and as soon as we can get that sort of a system in place, we can avoid the problem of having a conservative government with policies that are completely off track with where most Canadians want to go, whether it's foreign policy, Afghanistan, Kyoto and climate change, cuts to social programs that are important for vulnerable groups. I mean, there's quite a long list where Mr. Harper's off base. We wouldn't have that going on, given that two-thirds of Canadians voted for different visions of Canada than that.
How are we, though, on the path to electoral reform federally? I know that in this province it sort of went off the rails with STV How are we on the federal scene?
Well, it's probably premature to say because it's never really made much headway on the federal level. We're trying to bring it forward in a way that galvanizes some attention, and we're just going to keep at that.
Mr. Layton, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I guess you're stumping for candidates this morning, are you not?
Yes. Well, we've got a municipal election on the go here in Toronto, and I'm out on the streets on the Danforth in my riding. So it's I apologize for the background racket. It's just the sounds of a busy and popular street.
Now, you talk in the book about your career in municipal politics before. What are some of the lessons that you draw from that you've taken to federal politics?
Well, first, that you actually can get things done if you're willing to, from time to time, work with those who are on the other side of the picture. Because after all, most Canadians aren't intensely partisan people. They want to see some results. You know, I think of the family that's worried about their child who has to use a puffer all the time in a big city because they can't breathe the air. They want that cleaned up. Or the working person who's not sure if their manufacturing job, but a decent wage is going to be there, and they'll have to go down and maybe take two jobs to get the same income for their family. There's a lot of things on people's minds, and I find that it's important when you're elected to try to find a way to make those the legislatures work for the people. And sure, there's some partisanry that goes on, but it's good if you can actually focus on finding some ways forward. So I learned that from municipal politics. I also learned that it is possible to take good ideas from the public and turn them into actual programs. And certainly in my own city, we've seen some of that. And I've had the chance to be involved in many projects on the environment and on the social side that are recounted in the book. Often they're very rarely ideas from the politicians themselves. It's a question of those of us who are elected taking those good ideas we get from the public or that we've seen elsewhere and making them happen here and not talking about them endlessly.
Now, in the book, when the book came out in 2004, you were sort of introducing yourself to Canadians. The book has been since revised. Did you find that the NDP is relevant today? I mean, you have Elizabeth May and the Green Party gaining some recognition with Canadians. You have Bob Rae, a former NDP premier, who is now running for the Liberals, suggesting that your party is devoid of ideas and incapable of governing and is a party of protest. How do you talk to Canadians today about the NDP that you're leading?
Well, I guess Mr. Rae hasn't had a chance to read my book or know more about the many ideas that we've not only advanced but that we have implemented. And, of course, the NDP has been in government in many provinces over the years, and with the exception of Mr. Rae's government, when he was in power in Ontario, we actually have the best record of financial management of any political party in the country, and that's according to the finance department that studied all of the different governments, provincial and federal, in Canada, and they found the NDP managed the money best, ran the most balanced budget. Of course, Mr. Rae was an exception to that. But, no, when it comes to the policies of our party, what I think people are seeing is that, first of all, we stand on principle. We're the party that right from the beginning said that we were headed down the wrong path on foreign policy by taking over the American mission in southern Afghanistan, that was not going to be the way to ultimately find peace and development there. And I believe more and more Canadians are concluding that we were right on that score. When it comes to environment, I think what we've shown is that we don't just talk about it. We can actually deliver results. We have 29 members of parliament that are there getting results for people in minority parliaments, and I think that's appreciated. But there's always more to do.
But do you think you're losing ground to the Greens or to the Liberals?
Well, actually, our support is up. So we went up from 1 million votes in 2000 to 2 million in 2004 and 2.5 million in 2006. So, and our members of parliament are increasing in numbers. So I would say we're on the right track, and people are seeing us as practical and principled, a party that knows what it wants and gets things done, and that's not me talking, that's the Globe and Mail.
Well, what do you think Canada's role should be in Afghanistan, the peacekeepers that we have there, what should their role be?
Well, we believe that it should not be this counterinsurgency warfighting combat effort that's causing us to have to send now tanks and howitzers that will be using $150,000 shells to bombard parts of southern Afghanistan. We think this is the wrong direction. We believe that our troops should be withdrawn, and we should let our NATO partners know, most of whom, by the way, are not involved in this war effort, have refused to participate because they think it's wrong-headed. It's a little bit too much like the strategy George Bush has adopted in Iraq, which is just increasing violence, not reducing it. And we see the same thing in southern Afghanistan. And so our party has called for Canada to pull out of that war-fighting effort and to do it safely, of course, and to notify those other partners that are there, but to begin to work with the UN and the many NATO countries that are by far from abandoning Afghanistan. They're not doing that, neither should Canada, but we should begin to engage in a new strategy there, working towards a ceasefire, working towards a diplomatic and political solutions, getting the combatants around the table, because negotiation and discussion is always better than war fighting when it comes to the average citizen, and that's the way we should go.
Back to the book for just a sec here. It is a very readable book, highly readable. When you wrote the book, and when it came out first, and now this new edition, what's the reaction been from people that have read the book? What do they tell you that they like about the book?
Well, I think that people have been very kind. They, of course, that's what they're going to tell me, I guess. But I've simply tried to recount the stories of good ideas being put into practice across the country, and some of my own experiences working with people to get results. And I guess there's an optimistic tone to it. It starts off in part with the message from my father. He always used to tell our kids, you know, don't miss the opportunity to serve if it comes along, and to try and get things done. And so the book is sort of permeated with that kind of optimism, and I'm fortunate to be with a partner in politics and in life, Olivia Chow, who's now a member of Parliament, but was with me on City Council for many years, who has that same optimistic approach, and indeed our party is always focused not necessarily on power so much as on getting results. I mean, look at Medicare for Canada, brought by the NDP, even though Tommy Douglas was never Prime Minister. And so there's a lot of that sort of history and that sort of engagement that's talked about in the book, and maybe people appreciate a little bit of optimism every now and again.
Do you find, though, with the young people that you talk to, that they are optimistic, that they are drawn to serve in public life, as you were?
More and more I find that's the case, and I've been teaching for, I hate to tell you how many decades, colleges and universities and so on, And I do find a real sense of optimism, but also a sense of urgency amongst young people today. I think they see that the transformations of the environment that are happening so rapidly are going to have an enormous impact on them, and they're very frustrated at how slow our society seems to be willing to respond, even though they know there are many solutions available and that we could get started on them. And that's, I think, very frustrating to young people, and so I'm very enthused by going to colleges and campuses, which I have been doing a lot of, and hundreds of people coming out with this sense of energy. It's really quite exciting to see.
Mr. Layton, I want to thank you for joining us today, and congratulations on, and good luck with this book.
You're very kind, and I hope people find it useful, and it'll probably stimulate even more good ideas out there that perhaps we can then incorporate in future editions, or at least get into government policy, which I guess more relevant.
Very good. Would you hang on the line for just a sec here? I want to ask you one more thing.